Okay, good morning everyone. We are continuing our study in Exodus, and we'll be picking up in the latter part of chapter 15. Before we do, let's go and do our chapter summaries. And of course, it's getting harder as we, you know, progress, harder to remember. Chapter 1. All right, new Pharaoh, good. Chapter 2. Okay, good. Moses is born. Chapter 3. Burning bush, good. Chapter 4. Aaron joins, good. Chapter 5.
Increased labor.
Good job, increased labor. All right, chapter 6. Yeah, Moses loses courage. Good job. Chapter 7 is going to start the plagues, all right? And I understand if you don't remember them all in order, but remember our mnemonic. What is the mnemonic? Never forget God's fierce punishment because he loathes defiant foes. Adam gave a pretty good way to remember in terms of the way Exodus is laid out, and that is 7 to 11. So chapter 7 to 11 are all the plagues, all right? So maybe you can remember it like 7-11 plagues from heaven, all right? Good little rhyming thing that'll help you remember. So in chapter 11, the firstborn dies, and then chapter 12, all right, Passover is instituted. Chapter 13 was a little new from last time, but what do they need to do with their firstborn because of the Passover? Yeah, they consecrate the firstborn or sanctify, set apart, okay, their firstborn from their households, okay? In chapter 14, the big event in Exodus is crossing the sea, all right, in chapter 14. And then what happens after they cross the sea in chapter 15? What's their reaction? Yeah, rejoicing in song, the song of Moses. All right, well, now this morning we're going to start in chapter 16. We'll start at the end of 15. But then we'll get into 16, which is the manna. And chapter 17 is the water from the rock and also the attack of the Amalekites. And then chapter 18, which is the council of Jethro. Now, technically, we're not actually going to even get to chapter 18 this morning. We're just going to do the end of 15, 16, 17. Then we'll do 18 starting in the next class. It's a little different from the way the Waldron book has it, but I just didn't have time. There's just no way to get 18 in there. All right, very good. 16 is manna. Is that what you asked? 15, sorry. The rejoicing in song, or the song of Moses. Either way you want to look at that. All right, very good. Well, let's go ahead and have a prayer, and then we'll get into our text. Father in heaven, we are so humbled to be in your presence. You are so great and awesome. We pray that our hearts will reflect our attitude towards you of reverence and of praise and of giving you all glory. Thank you for your word and the way that it builds us up in our faith, helps us to trust in you, and bless us as we study Exodus this morning to learn from the good examples and the bad examples of the Israelites, and of course, the good example that you always set for us. Forgive us when we fail you. Bless us always in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so last class, we got to the end of the Song of Moses in chapter 15, where all the Israelites are praising God in gratitude for what he's done, but unfortunately, that gratitude is very short-lived. It didn't take long for them to forget about God's powerful hand that delivered them from Egypt. So, we come to chapter 15, verse 22 through 27, and you have this journey south toward Sinai. And again, we don't know exactly where it is, but I'll show you in a map in a second. Well, let's actually read verses 22 through 25. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, it was named Marah. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And then he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and he threw it into the waters, and the waters became sweet. There he made for them a statute and regulation, and there he tested them. Okay, let's look at the map for just a second to track their travels. There's the wilderness of Shur. Okay, it's a pretty large area. And after they crossed the Red Sea, and again, remember, we can't be 100% sure of these locations. Adam and I are just using these locations because it's in the Waldron books, and it's how he has them in the book. But essentially, they're going to be traveling down southward here toward, eventually, Mount Sinai. And sometimes we think, when we think of a wilderness today, we think of a jungle. But that's not really what a wilderness was like. It was more like a desert. And it was very hard to find to find water sources, very hard to find food. And so over the next three chapters, there's going to be a lot of grumbling and complaining against God and Moses. First about water, bitter water, and then about a lack of food, and then about a lack of water in chapter 17. And what we're going to see in these three chapters are comparisons and contrasts between what the Israelites went through in Egypt and what they're going through now in the wilderness with God. And we're going to see comparisons and contrasts between the way God treated the Egyptians and the way God treated the people of Israel. So just in these three verses, do you see any parallels with their recent experience in Egypt? So they're greeted by bitter waters, right? Egypt, in Exodus chapter 1, verse 14, says that Pharaoh made their lives bitter with hard labor of all kinds. And now what we see is a version of the plague God sent on the Nile, but in reverse. Remember, in Egypt, he took the Nile, which had good and sweet water, and he turned it into blood, which would have been bitter and undrinkable. But here, he takes this bitter, undrinkable water, and he makes it sweet for his people. God continues to take the same power that he used to judge Egypt, but to bless his own people. And probably a good question to ask is, did the Israelites deserve for God to bless them like this? No, of course not. They're griping and grumbling, and they're basically asking, Moses, what, you expect us to drink this? And again, their gratitude in the Song of Moses was short-lived, but God is so merciful, and he's patient with them. Continue in this text, verse 25 or verse 26. He said, if you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have put on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer. And then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 date palms, and they camped there beside the waters. I find it interesting that even though the Israelites are God's people, he essentially tells them, look, if you disobey me like the Egyptians did, I will treat you exactly like I treated the Egyptians. I'll send the plagues on you as well. But if you'll obey me, I'm your healer. I'm your source of life. So while God shows great favor to the Israelites, the privilege of being his people comes with great responsibility. And he says, look, if you abandon me and you want to live like the Egyptians, you'll suffer like the Egyptians. Isn't that true of us as Christians? That yes, we have these great blessings in Christ, but if we abandon Christ and we go and live like the rest of the world, God says, well, I'm going to judge you like the rest of the world. And you find in verse 27, they come to this desert oasis. And while these chapters point backward to their time in Egypt, they also foreshadow the good blessings to come in the land of Canaan. I think this verse 27 is a microcosm of the blessings they're going to inherit when they come to this land flowing with milk and honey. You have these 70 date palms. It's just this beautiful oasis where they have plenty of water, and dates would have been a very sweet fruit. See, God has the power to bless them at any time. And they have absolutely no reason to doubt that he can bless them and that he will bless them. Yet that's exactly the struggle in these chapters. They don't trust God. They don't trust him. In fact, God called it a test back in verse 25. God is purposely using these trials in the wilderness to test whether they really trust him or not, whether they're going to trust him in the hard times or not. And of course, they fail that test over and over again. And I'll make one more point about this and ask for comments and questions. Just because they left Egypt didn't mean they wouldn't suffer anymore. I find it interesting that they were bitter in Egypt and then they come out of Egypt with God, and yet they still kind of come up on these bitter waters and these hard times. You see, but the difference is when you're God's people, you suffer with hope. You suffer because everybody suffers in this life. It's a hard, sin-cursed world. But the people of God have hope. If you're not a Christian, if you're with Satan, just like when they were under Pharaoh, they suffered in Egypt, but it was a hopeless, endless kind of a suffering. And that's the same way it is for us. If we are not with God, we will suffer too. But there's no hope for any bitter thing to be made sweet. Satan only takes bitter things and makes them more bitter. God has the power to take the bitter and make them into something sweet. Comments or thoughts on that chapter? Bill?
Basically, it seems to me, if these folks, they went into the wilderness and it got a little tough, and they lost their interest, if you will, in God, and they suffered because they did not do what the Father told them to do. Mm-hmm. And that has been their problem for generations.
Yeah,
they
absolutely
don't do what the Father says.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that leads to difficulty for them. Mm-hmm. And we can go through all of those.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about the spies yet. And all
sure,
that.
Yeah, that'll come later. But yeah, that's a great point. They don't trust God.
Well, that's, and they don't do what God says.
Exactly.
And basically, God tested them.
Yes.
As you pointed out, in the wilderness, with all these things.
Yep.
And as I recall the stories, God gave them all of what they wanted. He gave them bread.
Yes, great point.
He gave them jobs or some kind of to eat.
Yes, good point. Water. Yeah, you got it. Any other comments or thoughts on this section? Terry, and then Vanessa.
I just find it interesting, you know, you read through this and you read about the lack of trust that the Israelites have, and you apply that to your life today. And how people, they really, over time, we really don't change.
Okay.
You know, it's just it's a growing process. You can see the Israelites in their immaturity, going with God, you know, to the promised land. And then you look at your own life, you know, and our promised land is something that's not of this world.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's, you know, for some of us, it's going to be far off in the future. And, you know, and you really got to put a lot of faith in God for that. And
yeah,
you really have to. And it's just a growing process.
Absolutely. Yeah, and Terry's making a great point that people never change. That their struggle is really our struggle. We're headed toward the promised land of heaven, and we're traveling through the wilderness of this life. That's why the Bible's not dry history, because these are people that are us. I mean, we're reading about us. And Terry mentioned, you know, it's a growing period. Think about it. If coming across the Red Sea was their birth as a nation, that means the wilderness period is their infancy as a nation. They're like little children learning and struggling to trust in God. And God is so patient with them through that. And He is for us as well. Vanessa. Oh, okay. She was going to say the same. Good. All right. Well, good. Yeah, really good thoughts. Let's keep going. In chapter 16, we come to the passage about the manna. Let's read verses 1 through 3. Then they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the sons of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." So again, if you track their travels, they leave from Marah, and they're just going a little bit of a ways to Elim and into the wilderness of Sin. Now, the wilderness of Sin is probably not called Sin because of evil, like not that they committed sin there, but because it's near Sinai. The root words are very similar. But again, these locations are not known for sure. Please don't think I'm being dogmatic about these locations. Here's a question. They've only been gone from Egypt for 1 month. And yet, what are they worried is going to happen? Yeah, that God's just going to kill us. He's just going to let us die out here in the wilderness. That is just so absurd. I mean, physically, right, we understand when we get hungry, right, we don't think straight. You know, we get a little hangry is what we call it. The Snickers commercial, right? You turn into a diva. Okay, but that's not really what's happening here with the Israelites. This isn't just hanger that's going on here. What is the heart of the cause of their grumbling? We actually learn this from the New Testament in Hebrews chapter 3. But what is the heart of the cause of their grumbling? And we've mentioned it already. Matt? Yeah, unbelief. Unbelief. They do not trust God. They're still not convinced that He has their best interests at heart and that they can trust Him, which is absolutely absurd considering all they've just seen just within the last month. They saw all the plagues in Egypt. They saw the Red Sea part. They saw this miracle at Mara with the bitter waters becoming sweet. They see this great desert oasis in Elam. And after all that, they still don't think God's going to take care of them. And this is what's so sad, is that the Israelites are acting with just as much unbelief as Pharaoh did. Pharaoh did not believe God was powerful enough to provide for his people. And now his people think the same thing. They don't believe he's powerful enough to take care of them either. Or at least if he's powerful enough, they don't think he's interested enough and that he cares enough to take care of them, that he's just going to let them die. And yet, here's what I find so amazing. Even though Pharaoh and the Israelites had a similar kind of unbelief, God cursed Pharaoh for his unbelief. And yet, what does God do here with the Israelites in response to their unbelief?
He makes a veil.
Yeah, he blesses them. Rather than sending hail and fire from heaven as a plague, look in verse 4. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them, whether or not they will walk in my instruction." And then drop down to verse 12, because I want you to see another parallel with Egypt. Verse 12, "I have heard the grumblings of the sons of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am Yahweh, your God." Does that phrase look familiar? "You shall know that I am Yahweh" is repeated over and over again during the plagues, when God was trying to convince the Egyptians that he was Yahweh. And now the Israelites have the same lack of faith that the Egyptians had. And now he's got to convince his own people, because they're still unconvinced that he's Yahweh. But interestingly, with Egypt, he used the plagues to demonstrate that he was Yahweh. With Israel, he's using blessings to demonstrate that he is Yahweh. He can do both. It's both blessings and curses are an equal part of God's nature and how he interacts with humanity. Randy, did you have something earlier?
Yeah, I was just going to say there's a lesson for us throughout this, in that it doesn't take a large number of people with a lack of faith. If enough other people lend an ear to it, it's spread like wildfire.
Okay, good. And I think we're going to learn a little bit later that part of the reason for the unbelief in the camp of Israel was from some of the rabble that also came out of Egypt with them. They kind of instigated some of this stuff, especially when they start complaining about Moses being their leader. You know, who made you ruler over us? That's later in Numbers. But disbelief can spread throughout a congregation if some people struggle with it. Matt?
Sometimes we probably are a little too hard on them. But, less than a month is pretty short.
It's pretty short.
And I think, to me, what I see, to expand on Randy's point, is I think that also speaks to, it's been 400 years of that, like you said, hopeless oppression, suffering. It's culturally ingrained in them to be beat down, negative, hopeless.
Oh, good point.
And I think sometimes to apply that to now, we can discount sometimes if someone comes out of a different lifestyle, comes out of the world, they're a Christian, and maybe we see, they're baptized and then they struggle with some things. They were just bad. You can't discount all that cultural baggage, that history. That is significant sometimes.
Yeah, I like that. I really like that thought, that they've kind of been conditioned to be grumblers in Egypt and to be hopeless. And so when they come to God, it's hard to shake that. And this is the power of what God does for us and what Jesus does for us, is he tries to say, look, I don't want you to think the same way you used to think under Satan. Because under Satan, you were trapped. There was no way out. Everything was horrible and awful. But now that you've come to me, you need to know there's hope. There's a future for you as my people, and I'm going to bless you. And it's just hard when you've been so beaten down to trust that God really is going to bless you when it's been so long since you've been blessed. So, yeah, great point, Nessa.
And I think for us today. Over the years, there was certainly a few generations there where we were very scared to discuss the physical blessings that we have from God, that there was that sort of evangelical movement that mm-hmm. we didn't want to take it too far. Well, this is a miracle, or this is something from God. Well, I think even though we don't have the plagues, we don't have these miracles that God did back then, we still need to give credit where credit's due and say, and not be scared to say, this was a blessing from God.
Yeah.
That maybe you don't know it. Maybe you don't always know it. Maybe, mm-hmm. you know, but to give that credit and to that will always build your strength. And
Yeah, absolutely. God still is giving us physical blessings in this life. The new covenant is really based on spiritual blessings, as opposed to the old covenant, which was a little bit more based on physical blessings. But it still remains true. We have many physical blessings, and we should probably change our language about that. Sometimes I hear Christians say, oh, you know, we found, I don't know, fill in the blank, this new car, I found these nice shoes, or they were perfect for me for work, and we'll say something like, you know, I just got really lucky that I found these. Well, was it luck, or do you believe that God is actually blessing you with good things? I mean, let's be careful not to just say, well, everything's just luck and chance, when if we're really going to give thanks, let's give thanks to God for all the good blessings that we have in this life. Something the Israelites definitely did not do. Jack?
Jesus did recognize the difference between seeing something and not seeing something and believing, because when Thomas said, I believe, he said, you believe because you have seen my wounds. Blessed are they who have not seen but believe.
Yeah, great point. Because there's so many things still, even though we have physical blessings, there's so many spiritual blessings coming our way, especially in heaven, that we haven't seen yet. And so we have to trust God in the unseen things. Yeah, really good comments. Let's actually keep reading verse 13 through 15. So it came about at evening that the quails came up and covered the camp. And in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. And when the layer of dew evaporated, behold, on the surface of the wilderness, there was a fine flake-like thing, fine as the frost on the ground. And when the sons of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. Now flip over to verse 31, because we actually find a description of the manna in verse 31. The house of Israel named it manna. And it was like coriander seed, white, and its taste was like wafers with honey. Okay, so this wasn't just completely boring. It did taste sweet. Okay, now, it would have been boring after 40 years of eating it, but they weren't supposed to be eating it for 40 years. That was their fault because of their sin. But God miraculously provides this bread for them from the dew of the ground. And it's interesting, the word manna comes from the Hebrew word manhu, which means, what is it? That's what manna means. What in the world is that? We've never seen it before. Is it good? I don't know what it is. Well, yeah, it was good. It was an answer to their grumbling prayer that they don't have food. Now they not only have food that day, they have food every day moving forward because God is providing this for them.
Except one day.
However, yeah, I'm going to talk about that in just a second. However, in order to test them, to see whether or not they would believe and trust in Him, He set restrictions on how they should gather this and on when they should gather this. So consider four restrictions He put on them. One, only one omer full per person per day could be collected. Omer full, roughly 2 quarts full. Also, you had to gather it in the morning, because if you waited too long and the sun came out, it would melt. Verse 21 says that. You're also not allowed to hoard it. So if you go out and you collect your 2 quarts or your omer full for that day, you're not allowed to save any for the next day. What would happen if they saved any for the next day? Yeah, it would spoil. It would go foul. Okay. And lastly, and this is what Bill mentioned, you could not go out on the seventh day to collect it, because that was the Sabbath day. So what you would do is, you would go collect the double portion. You collect 2 omers full per person on the 6th day, and you would save, you know, that extra portion for the 7th, so that you would have enough on the 7th, but you wouldn't actually have to go out and collect it. Here's my question. How would these rules be a test for the Israelites? Why would it be difficult, do you think, to follow these rules?
Well, that's
Deanne?
they didn't.
They had to be patient.
And if they didn't believe, that they didn't know they would actually have it the next day.
Okay, good. If you didn't have faith, you didn't really know if you were going to have it the next day. Yeah, there's manna today, but what about tomorrow and what about next week? Shouldn't I be hoarding it up? Shouldn't I be, you know, saving this? Well, no, don't do it. You only collect what you need for today, and that is it. Give us this day our daily bread, as Jesus prays. And that's very hard when you have a whole ground covered with bread to not gather more than one omerful and to not hoard it up for months and months. They have to trust. Look, God will give it. God will give it to us tomorrow as well. It takes... all right, go ahead, Mary.
I was just going to say, they're arbitrary. You know, there's no rational reason.
From their perspective, yeah. It doesn't seem rational.
It doesn't make any sense.
Okay, maybe it just seems arbitrary. And yeah, sometimes God asks us to do things we don't understand. But that's where trust comes in. We do it anyway because we know He knows better than we do. Chloe?
So did it fall on Sabbath day?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Good question. Yeah, good question.
They couldn't gather.
Okay, yeah.
They're not supposed to, they couldn't even gather.
Okay, good point, because look in verse 16, or let's see, verse 27 of chapter 16. It came about on the seventh day that some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. So there's, yeah, good question. So it wasn't even there, okay, on the seventh. And think about this. If every time you collect more than you're supposed to, it goes bad the next day. Well, on the sixth day, you go out and you collect more than you're supposed to. Do you think, what do you think is going to happen to it? Well, it's going to spoil on the seventh. God says it's not going to spoil on the seventh. It'll spoil every other day you collect too much. But if you collect too much on the sixth, it'll be fine on the seventh. You see? A lot of trust here. A lot of faith just in these instructions. How do they do with those instructions? Not well. They just ignore it. We just read verse 27. They went out on the Sabbath looking for, you know, looking for bread, looking for manna. They didn't find it. And look what God says in verse 28. How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions? And that, again, that's a parallel to Exodus 10, verse 3, where he asked Pharaoh, how long before you humble yourself before me and obey me and let my people go? He's asking the Israelites the same thing. Why don't you listen to me? Why don't you trust me? Not only did they try to gather on the Sabbath, but look back in verse 20. Verse 20 says, but they did not listen to Moses, and some left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and became foul, and Moses was angry with them. So they violated this on multiple fronts. Okay? And... let me catch up on my notes here. This is the first introduction of the Israelites to the Sabbath day. It was to be a day of rest, a day to trust in God's provision for you, a day to rest in your relationship with God. God was trying to bless them with the Sabbath day because he's saying, look, you don't have to worry about provision. You just trust in me, you obey me, and you can have rest. But the problem is the Israelites were restless on the Sabbath. And that's going to be a pattern all throughout the Old Testament. One of the things that the prophets will rebuke the people for later on in their history is that they weren't keeping the Sabbath day. They were going out and doing business on the Sabbath day just like the rest of the world, which again takes great trust. They weren't receiving manna every day. That was later on. They weren't receiving manna anymore. You had to go out and work for your food. So they're thinking, you know, it's kind of like you think about Chick-fil-A closing on Sunday. Doesn't that take a lot of trust, right? The rest of the world is open on Sunday. Everybody else is making money. Everybody else is, you know, doing business and getting richer and richer. And Chick-fil-A is saying, well, too bad. We're just going to trust God and we're not going to be open on Sunday. That's a more modern example, but this is what was going on in Israelite history. They didn't trust God enough. They were so consumed by trying to fill their stomachs and going out and working and laboring and making money and gaining possessions like the rest of the world, and they were not keeping the Sabbath day. And we already see a hint of that here at this first introduction. Let me say one more thing about this, and then I'll open for comments. Verse 33 of chapter 16, Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer full of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. God actually tells the Israelites to store some manna in a jar. And eventually we'll learn, once they build the Ark of the Covenant, they're going to put that in the Ark of the Covenant. And it's going to be a reminder to them of God's provision in the wilderness forever. Now let me make this very important point about that. The point of putting the manna in the jar is not so that the Israelites would remember the manna as the source of their life, but that they would remember Yahweh as the source of their life. This is a huge, huge distinction. We're going to talk more about that in the sermon. Comments or questions on that chapter, chapter 16? Randy?
Just real quick. Someone might have thought when this first started about manna, well, I want to make sure my family doesn't go hungry, so I'll collect a little bit more. And the lesson from that is, even something done with noble intentions can still be wrong.
Okay, yeah. Even if you have noble intentions, like he's saying, look, maybe they wanted to provide for their family. I'm going to collect extra because, look, my boy, he's a teenage boy. He's a growing boy. He needs his manna, you know. Well, I'm going to collect more for him because I want to take care of my family. It doesn't matter whether you want to take care of your family or not. It matters whether you obey God. And guess what? God was going to take care of their family. That's the point. God was not going to let your family starve. You had to trust that. God was going to take care of your growing teenage boys, too, with manna. Good thought. Matt?
Mary's point made me think of something. Because every day it would spoil the next day. If that just continued, they would get complacent and think, well, this is just how this manna stuff is. It would be a routine. But because every week the rules changed, that should have been, that's God's intention, I think, to be a reminder every week, nope, this is not just this manna stuff that happens naturally. This is from me.
Okay, good.
Because the laws of nature don't apply.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's...
So it's supposed to be that constant reminder, which then we have in the bread and the parallel.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We have a weekly reminder of God's miraculous provision for us. This was not just a natural occurrence, which is why they said, what is it? Because they didn't see this happen naturally. This was very miraculous. Steve?
On day 6, did they have a double portion of quail also?
No, that's a good question. We don't read much about the quail. He mentions the quail like once or twice, but then it's the manna that seems like it's kind of a continual thing. So, did they have a double portion of quail too? Maybe. I don't know how long that lasted. I don't know how long they continued on the quail diet. That's a good question.
Well, it stopped at some point because they started complaining that they had no meat.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. So later in the book of Numbers, they complain that we don't have any meat.
Right.
And then God, God's patience runs out at that point. He's going to punish them. Yes, he's so patient and loving kindness, but his patience has a limit. All right, and you see that later, he punishes them. Yeah, good point. It must have stopped at some point. All right. Well, let's go ahead and look in chapter 17. More of the same, sadly, from the Israelites. Verses 1 through 3. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim, or Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? Interesting. Back in Egypt, the dry ground of the Red Sea was a source of their salvation. Here, the dry ground of the wilderness is a source of complaint. Also, the dry ground of the Red Sea was proof that God was with them. But here, the dry ground of the wilderness causes them to doubt that God is with them. In fact, they ask an astounding question in verse 7, is Yahweh among us or not? What a tragic question after all they've been through. They still think they'd be better off in Egypt. God should have just let them die there because he's just going to let them die here in the wilderness. And then the Israelites basically reject Moses like Pharaoh rejected Moses. Look in verse 4. So Moses cried out to the Lord saying, what shall I do to this people? A little more and they will stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. And take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you will strike the rock, and water will come out of it that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So Moses is afraid for his life from this angry, thirsty mob, essentially. And yet, once again, instead of God sending a plague on the Egyptians, on the Israelites, he sends them a blessing. He takes the same staff that he used to curse the Nile, and he blesses them with water. Again, I think all these little details in the narrative are meant to show us this comparison and contrast between the Israelites and the Egyptians in their hearts.
Didn't he get in trouble
when he hit the...
Later.
This is later.
That is later, yeah. He'll have trouble later. He does the wrong thing with the rock. And yeah, but that...
That's later.
That's good. That's going to come later. Yeah, good question. Here's my question. Why is it so wrong to test Yahweh? He says, why do you test Yahweh? In fact, later in Deuteronomy 6:16, it'll be a law that you shall not put Yahweh your God to the test as you tested him at Massa, or Massa, which is this location right here. Why is it so wrong to test God? Think about that.
Because he can't be tested. He does not cause us to be tempted. We do that ourselves.
Okay, yeah, that's true. Okay, so if you're thinking of maybe temptation.
Sure.
Sure, Chloe?
I feel like it's kind of biting the hand that feeds you.
All right.
So he's providing so much for you, and you turn around and go, oh, this isn't good enough, and find a way to test him.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation, Jack.
Because it is a sign of unbelief.
All right.
Unbelief is the reason given. Sure. Fully and completely, yeah. For the people who died in the wilderness and were not allowed to enter into the rest.
Yeah, think
about it. Unbelief is the strong current.
Right, because think about it. Why do we test things? We test them because we're not sure they're reliable.
See if it's true.
Doctors test your body, run tests on your body, because they're not sure if it's working properly or not. You know, we take tests in school and make sure that our brains are learning properly and that we're getting this information. We test cars to make sure that they're safe. But you see, all the common thread between why we test things is to make sure, because we're not sure. And that's where the unbelief comes in. They're not sure that God is reliable. And so they're testing him still to say, show us whether you really are with us. Prove to us, God, that you really are reliable, and prove it by giving us water. And when you think about it that way, it really helps us appreciate God's patience and his loving kindness toward them. Because guess what? That would have been very painful for God and insulting to God after all he's done for them. And now, as Chloe said, they're biting the hand that is feeding them and giving them life. And you know what? If we're not careful, we can do the same thing. They will say to God, if you're really my heavenly Father, or if you're really real God, then you'll do this for me, or you'll prove it by doing X or Y for me, or if you'll do this for me, then I'll believe. I see John over there. How sad. When we feel the need to test the Creator and Savior of the world. John.
Going with what Matt said earlier, in this country, we are a people for generations who have been taught to question authority,
good.
Test authority. It's been ingrained in us. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on, he's talking to me.
Of course.
I question authority all the time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. No.
All right. You don't see students handing the test, you know, putting the test through to the professor, mm-hmm. or things like that. We've got to learn to, you know, kind of step back and pause for a second and kind of look at the big picture. Because we want to attack it right there and then.
Mm-hmm.
That's been ingrained in us. It's like, show me, don't tell me.
Yeah, absolutely. So John's making the point, we're a society that really is all about testing authority.
We are a stubborn society.
Yeah, we want proof, and so before I buy it on Amazon, I'm reading 100,000 reviews because I want to see 5 stars. If you don't have 5 stars, I'm not buying it. All right? We want that proof, and we turn around and we do the same thing to God. Are you a 5-star guy? Are you a 4-star guy? You know what? Should I serve you? Should I? Are you real?
This country is founded on a set of rights. Mm-hmm. We have our rights.
Yeah,
I have my rights.
We do. And I will add, though, God's not afraid of our testing. See, God's not afraid of the testing as in he thinks he's going to fail. He's given us so much evidence. The point is, we shouldn't have to test him. He's already given us. Just look around at this world. Just look at the human body. Look at history. What Jesus and the Bible and all these historical things from archaeology. I mean, God over and over again has already proven himself reliable and trustworthy. So he's not afraid of our tests. He just wants us to stop thinking we need to keep trying to test him. he's already worthy and passed all tests that could be given him. Let me talk about this last section here, verses 8 through 16. Really appreciate your comments. Verse 8 through 16, here they're ambushed by the Amalekites. Amalek was one of Esau's grandsons, and his people ambushed the Israelites because they're pretty vulnerable when you think about it. These aren't trained soldiers. They are traveling with a huge number of people, with women and children and animals and carts and all of that stuff. And so they're an easy target for being plundered. But what they didn't count on, of course, was that Yahweh was among them. The very question the Israelites were wondering, is Yahweh among us? He once again answers very clearly in this passage, yes, I'm among you. Because here's this marauding band of, you know, nomadic peoples, the Amalekites, who have ambushed you. And yet God destroys them and defeats them. He doesn't fully destroy them, but he defeats them in this battle. And I find it interesting, instead of God just sending a plague on the Amalekites, he actually charges the Israelites to fight. Yes, God was with them, but this time he wants the Israelites to actually go to battle. And I believe, again, this is a foreshadowing of what's to come when they have to enter the promised land. God is teaching them, yes, I will be with you, but you're going to have to actually go take up arms against your enemies. In fact, that's probably why we get this introduction to Joshua seemingly out of nowhere. We've never seen him before in the text. He's just all of a sudden here, and nobody says a thing about Joshua or introduces him as a character. Well, why? Because just as he's seen leading the Israelites into battle here, that's exactly what he's going to do later in their history. Remember Genesis 12:3, God tells Abraham, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. Is God happy about what happened here with the Amalekites? No. Furious with the Amalekites that they would attack the Israelites. And so just as he cursed the Egyptians with those plagues, so too he promises to never forget what the Amalekites have done here. And get this, especially because they are descendants of Esau, which means they're attacking their own brother. Attacking their own people here. And God makes good on this promise that you write it down as a memorial. I'm going to destroy the Amalekites. He makes good on that later in 1 Samuel chapter 15 and then later in chapter 30. The Amalekites also, here's something interesting, were some of the people in the land of Canaan later in Numbers that the Israelites were afraid of. He said, look, we can't go in there. You know, the Amalekites are in there and there's some other people in there. So even though God defeated the Amalekites here, later they still don't trust him to defeat the Amalekites in the land of Canaan. And this is also a foreshadowing of the rivalry in the rest of the Bible between Israel and Esau's descendants. Started between Jacob and Esau, that tension. Now we see it here, and we're going to see it all throughout history. The people of Esau would be called the Edomites. And they would often laugh at the calamity of the Israelites in hard times. They refused to help them. Haman, in the book of Esther, was a descendant of the Amalekites. He tried to have the entire Jewish nation destroyed. Even in the New Testament, you come to Herod the Great. He was an Idumean. He was a descendant of Esau. And he tries to kill Jesus when he was a baby. Yet, God's people always triumph. Because Yahweh is the one true God. And not only can his blessings be counted on, his curses on his enemies can be counted on as well. Comments or thoughts on that chapter? Randy.
As to why is it wrong to test God? Well, a test is a challenge. In order to test God or challenge him, we have to raise our status, and that's a pride problem.
Okay, yeah. So there's an arrogance involved in thinking that we are the standard by which God is to be tested. It's a really good point. Gail.
Every time they didn't have blessings was when they complained the loudest. And I think sometimes we do the same thing. As long as we're being blessed, we can, everything's great for us. And the minute we're challenged by something, whether it's physically or spiritually, we just want to walk away.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's why it's the hard times that are really the tests of our faith. It's easy to serve God when everything's going great. But God wants to strengthen our faith in him with the trials. Okay, great comments. Thank you so much. Read through page 46 of the Waldron book for next class. Really appreciate it.